Close, tall and proud in his bright orange jacket. A balaclava covered most of his face, but the exposed wrinkles around his eyes left no doubt that he was smiling broadly under the layers of fleece. Carlos had conquered that mountain, just because he could. Chapter 22. What Hurts the Most. My friendship with Carlos was built on the shared pursuit of pain, riding bikes up mountain grinds, easy swims that always turned into breakneck competitions, pushing each other out of the way as we sprinted back to a trailhead. Last one to the car has to pay for coffee. I thought I knew what pain was. But when cancer consumed Carlos's body, pain took on a new meaning. Before, pain was part of a game we played, the result of a search for what we were made of. After his diagnosis, Carlos's body preemptively answered that question, and the answer was, those fucking tumors. I couldn't relate to the pain he was feeling the way I could empathize with a muscle cramp or a bike crash. I would have given anything for the days when our biggest problem was a muscle cramp or a bike crash. There was nothing fun about this pain. Chemotherapy caused Carlos to curl into a fetal position on the floor for entire days and nights. Surgeries left him covered in scars. Experimental treatments tested his physical and mental limits. And yet somehow he remained willing, even grateful, to accept the pain. To him, the pain of Iron Man and the pain of cancer were two sides of the same coin. "The pain lets me know I'm alive," he said with determination. "When the pain stops, that means I've stopped." Shortly after Carlos summited Pico de Orizaba, the tumors spread dramatically. The cancer had mutated to resist chemotherapy, and scans of his liver and lungs were riddled with abnormalities. "Going to tell you something," Carlos texted late one night. "Promise you won't freak out." "Nothing freaks me out, sir," I replied. "What's up?" "At St. Joe's. Headaches, slurred speech, tumors in brain. Surgery in morning to remove."
"What?"
"I know," he replied. "Catholic hospital, right?" The brain surgery, though successful, was merely a stopgap. Within weeks, the tumors returned, and so did the pain. The masses in his lungs continued to sprout, causing shortness of breath, and Carlos experienced daily debilitating headaches from the swelling in his brain. He arranged for other professors to teach his classes, as he found it hard to leave his house most days. On the rare symptom-free day, he still chose the comforts of home. It was just too exhausting to leave. "It's time to talk about hospice care," the doctors said. "We can't try to cure you any more, but we can manage your pain and keep you comfortable until the end." "I don't want to be comfortable," Carlos huffed, pushing away the hospice brochures. "I'm not ready for that." To him, hospice meant giving up. It was where people went to die. Once he allowed palliative care, the pain would stop, but so would he. But the question was no longer whether he would die, but when. We steeled ourselves for the inevitable, hugging each other a little tighter with every "see you later," just in case it was the last time. I was scared. What kind of pain lay in wait for my friend? Was he really so stubborn that he would suffer until the end? I didn't know if I could bear the pain of watching that. I was out for a run one autumn day when I got a text message from his daughter, Emily. The brain swelling had become too much to bear, and Carlos was being admitted to a hospice facility immediately. Ready or not, he had reached the beginning of the end. Heart in my throat, I rushed to the facility, preparing for a grim, somber scene. Instead, I saw Carlos sitting up in bed, eating a burrito.
"Hey," he slurred with a groggy smile, "you're just in time for breakfast."
Here's the thing about hospice. It's a place where people go to die, yes, but it's also a place where pain is removed. It's a place where cries of agony can be replaced with sighs of relief. It's a place where caregivers no longer have to shoulder the burden of sustaining life,
and instead can focus on simply loving the patient. It's a place where volunteers work tirelessly to make sure a dying guy can get almost anything he damn well pleases, including opiates and a breakfast burrito. "Good drugs?" I asked as I leaned in to kiss his cheek. He gazed up at me through glazed eyes.
"Oh, yeah," he purred.
He stared over my shoulder for a second with an odd expression, and then gestured for me to come closer, as if to tell me a secret.
"I can make myself see red flowers," he disclosed with glee.
He squeezed his eyes tightly shut, then opened them rapidly, staring off into space with open-mouthed awe.
"Look! Look, isn't that great?"
It's amazing what opiates and a good breakfast burrito can do. Carlos was dying. That was an inescapable fact. But as difficult as it was for him to cede the battle, acceptance finally brought the warrior some relief. The fight, which was exhausting, was over. And for the first time since his diagnosis 4 years earlier, he looked calm, peaceful, even. Seeing him at peace made me feel at peace, too. For the next few days, I joined a rotation of friends and family members, keeping vigil at his bedside, holding his hand as he moved in and out of sleep. Sometimes he'd stir and start a brief but surprisingly lucid conversation about riding bikes or current events. Other times he'd ask me to pluck a red flower from his field of vision. Then he'd fall asleep again, only to wake up confused and muttering.
"Where am I?"
"You're at hospice, sir."
"Why am I here?"
"Your nurse thought you'd be more comfortable here."
"Oh."
He closed his eyes again, only to open one a few seconds later, and whisper curiously,
"Am I comfortable?"
"Yes." I smiled through tears. "Very." Carlos squeezed my hand as he closed his eyes once more.
"Good."
Chapter 23. He's gone. I was on the train when I got the text from Diane. "It's probably going to be soon. All the kids are with us. We're okay. We'll keep you posted." My train lurched to the right as it took a wide corner. The morning commuter scrambled to grab handles or chase down rolling coffee mugs. A gaggle of college students laughed loudly at a video playing on someone's phone screen. The man next to me rocked his head in time with the music blaring through his headphones. I sat at the back of the train, staring at the words on my phone screen. "It's probably going to be soon." Shortly before Carlos took his final turn for the worse, Neil, now my husband, had been offered a job in Salt Lake City. It was an incredible opportunity for us to live and work in the town where he'd spent his childhood. But the timing of the move was horrible. Neil told his company, "Would it be possible to wait until I had finished supporting a friend through the end of his life?" The answer from his higher-ups was no. A gentle, kind no, but a no nonetheless.
"Ah, for fuck's sake, Lakey,"
Carlos sighed with irritation when I nervously relayed the news.
"Why would you even ask his company that?"
"Well, I thought I should be here for—"
"What, sit around and wait for me to die?" He scoffed. "Come on, don't be a dumbass. This is a good opportunity that will last longer than I will. Go."
With a truckload of guilt and apprehension, I moved to Salt Lake City. I flew back to Phoenix often to check on Carlos, grateful for the stockpile of frequent flyer miles I had accrued on my credit card from years of triathlon expenditures. Finally, the sport had paid me back. In my naivete, I had assumed that I would be able to make it back to Phoenix when the time came for him to die. I would drop everything, get on the next flight, and rush to his bedside, as I had so many times before. But now, on the Salt Lake City Red Line, it was clear that that wasn't going to happen. I didn't know what to do. Despite the sad news, I didn't feel like crying. My default setting was to spring into action.
Stop this train. I want to get off. But to do what? Teleport to Phoenix? Stop Carlos from dying? Anything I could do would be completely useless. I bowed my head and closed my eyes, clasping my hands so tightly my knuckles turned white. I don't know why I prayed on the train, honestly. Like Carlos, I'm not much of a God person. I believe things happen because people make them happen, not some white-bearded, flowing-robed creature in the sky. Even the act of praying for Carlos made me wonder if he could somehow hear it, and if he could, was he rolling his eyes at me? But I did it anyway. I prayed that Carlos wouldn't feel any pain. I prayed for him to be free of fear. I prayed for his family to be strong. I prayed that he knew just how much he was loved. The train bell clanged as it came to my stop, a platform in front of the local university. I looked up at the row of buildings outside my window. In 15 minutes, I had an interview for a very promising teaching job on campus. I looked at the message on my phone once more and wondered if I should cancel. Oh, for fuck's sake, Lakey. What else are you gonna do? Sit around and wait for me to die? Hold the door, I called out as I gathered my portfolio and coat to rush off the train. Before entering my interview, I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and thought of Carlos. The image I conjured up wasn't one of him lying in bed, dying. Instead, he was reclining behind his desk on campus, smiling and catching flying M&Ms in his mouth. I don't remember much about that interview, except that I was offered the job on the spot. While waiting for a human resources person to arrive with the obligatory new hire forms, I excused myself and sneaked into the hallway to peek at my phone. A message from Emily was waiting. He's gone. Chapter 24. Above All. Carlos left behind very few instructions for his funeral. He had insisted that it didn't matter to him, because funerals were for the living, and he wouldn't be there. The funeral homes in Phoenix were all too small to host an event honoring Carlos Nunez. Instead, hundreds of us packed into an event center on a Sunday morning. Students and faculty members, neighbors, friends, and what seemed like every triathlete in the tri-state area. A few had even flown in from Europe. After meeting Carlos at overseas Ironman races, they'd maintained friendships spanning many years and many more miles. The gang from Ironman St. George was there, and we all laughed as we recounted how he had done the race with a broken bike. The very nice boy Carlos had tried to set me up with years ago was there, as was his new wife, who is a lovely person, and, in a cheeky twist, has an Ironman personal record faster than anything Carlos ever recorded. His oncology team was there, including Stern Nurse, who, finally, admitted that Carlos had been her favorite patient. A former student announced that he had signed up to do his very first Ironman and would use the race to raise money for the Carlos Nunez Scholarship Fund. We laughed and cried, but mostly we laughed. Despite his assertion to the contrary, Carlos Nunez was definitely there with us that day. And, as I had promised 4 years earlier in that hotel room in Flagstaff, I wrote a eulogy for my best friend. How are you? When Carlos Nunez asked that question, he wasn't engaging in social niceties. He truly wanted to know the answer. Each of us knew Carlos in different ways— accomplished professor, 13-time Ironman, champion for social justice, congenial neighbor, devoted family man. In all those roles, his trademark was the same. Carlos would ask, "How are you?" And he'd drop everything to hear the answer. For you, he had all the time in the world. We've learned many lessons from Carlos during his 50 years on Earth. Show up. Work hard. Learn from your mistakes. Stand up for what you believe in. Expect better. Fight. And above all, be good to others. Carlos Nunez lives on in us all.
When you leave today, you are not leaving Carlos behind. You are carrying him into the world. His legacy shines every time you go out of your way to make someone's day a little better. When you treat strangers like you would a friend. When you offer help even when you don't have the time. Carlos lives on in the smile that comes after you stop to ask, "How are you?" and mean it. Chapter 25. The New Normal.
"You know you'll spend more on fixing up this bike than what it's worth, right?"
My bike mechanic smiled, not kindly, but in that, "You poor sap, how can you be so stupid?" kind of way. I could have done without the attitude, but he was right.
10 years ago, when Carlos's tri-bike was a brand new specimen, it was considered top of the line. The technology was state-of-the-art, the frame geometry innovative, the brand coveted. But that was 10 years ago. In comparison to the other bikes in my garage, this one was an outdated piece of shit. Correction, an outdated piece of shit about to cost me a lot of money. The tires were empty and cracked, the skewers were missing, and the frame was covered in dust. A twisted cobweb dangled from the handlebars, which dangled from the frame by the shifter cables.
"You really want to ride this?" the bike mechanic asked.
I nodded. He cocked his head curiously.
"Don't you have other bikes?"
I nodded again. "But I want to ride this bike." He sighed, muttered something under his breath,
"You poor sap, how can you be so stupid?"
and began writing up a repair estimate. Technically, this outdated piece of shit did not belong to me. Carlos had insisted that I hang on to it after I finished Ironman Arizona, despite my serious doubts that I'd ever do another Ironman. "I'm sure someone else can use it now," I said to him after the race. "What about your neighbor? Didn't you say he wanted to do triathlon?" Carlos took a sip of his coffee and considered the proposal. Then he shook his head.
"Nah, I want you to hang on to it for a while longer. You're not done with it yet."
Every now and then he'd inquire about the bike. I'd say it was doing fine.
"You're keeping her clean?"
"Yes, sir."
"Don't break the fucking bike."
"I'm trying not to."
"It's a very nice bike, you know."
"I know." What I didn't tell him was that I hadn't ridden that bike since Ironman Arizona. Along with the loss of our regular Sunday morning rides had gone my motivation to train for triathlons. Long rides just weren't as much fun without him as a conversation partner. Then Carlos died, and his bike sat in my garage, collecting dust. The night before his funeral, my friend Ashley asked how I was holding up. "I haven't cried yet," I confessed. "Do you think that's weird?"
"People grieve in different ways, Susan," Ashley replied. "I don't think that's weird at all."
Still, I felt like I was doing the grief thing wrong. Wasn't I supposed to be doing something? My closest friend was dead. Shouldn't I be wailing, gnashing my teeth, shaking my fists at the sky in anger? Surely, if I could do those things, I could check off a few boxes in the grieving process and get my life back to normal. I tried many times to will a watershed moment into being. It never worked. Grief is a weird journey. As it turns out, you can't really push through it to get to the finish line because there isn't a finish line. Even the idea of getting back to normal is an absurd one. Months after the funeral, I'd still forget that Carlos wasn't alive anymore. Something would happen and I'd think, "Wait until Carlos hears about this." Sometimes I'd even go so far as to pull out my phone to text him. And then I'd feel the sharp pang of reality. I think Carlos knew I would have a difficult time adjusting to the new normal. Shortly before he died, we talked about what he wanted done with his ashes. One of the things he requested was that they be sprinkled in Austria, the site of his first Ironman. He asked if I'd do the race and take him along for the ride.
"It's perfect," he said excitedly. "You've already got my bike." Ah, yes, that outdated piece of shit in my garage. It had been 3 years since I'd last ridden it. Could it make it through another Ironman?
Could I make it through another Iron Man?
Wait a second.
I gave Carlos a suspicious look. Is this why you had me keep your bike?
I don't know what you're talking about, Susan.
Carlos scoffed, looking down at his coffee cup in an unsuccessful attempt to hide a mischievous grin. 3 months after Carlos died, I set out to make good on my promise. I cleared the cobwebs and lifted the bike off the rack it had languished on for far too long. Part of me felt guilty for neglecting the only tangible token I had of my best friend. The other part of me was resentful. Did I really have to ride this outdated piece of shit? For an Iron Man, no less? After picking up the spiffied-up bike from the mechanic, I took it out for a long ride in the sunshine. This could be the heartwarming part of the story, where I say that putting all my disposable income into fixing up this bike turned it into a brand new steed, that this 10-year-old machine had suddenly been transformed into a sleek bolt of greased lightning. Or maybe this could be the cathartic part of the story, where I say that riding my best friend's bike was an intense moment, and that at the summit of some beautiful mountain I finally cried. But neither of those things happened. I did not cry, and the outdated piece of shit was still an outdated piece of shit. And yet, on that ride, I felt better. Lighter. Almost, dare I say, normal. Wait until Carlos hears about this, I thought. Well, almost normal. The new normal, I supposed. I looked down at the bike and smiled. It's been a while, I said. We've got a lot to talk about. Chapter 26. There's a bike in those trees. Sometimes there is the plan, and then there is what actually happens. The plan? I fly to Austria and do the Ironman. After the race is over, I identify a place to scatter Carlos's ashes, a simple and poignant tribute. What actually happened? Not that. The days leading up to the race were equal parts bizarre and emotional. Weeks after picking up a portion of Carlos's ashes from his family, I still hadn't figured out how I was going to actually race with his remains. Diane gave me a small amount, no bigger than a deck of cards, in a satin lavender bag from the funeral home. "You're going to make him so proud, Susan," Diane said, as she handed me the satchel containing part of my best friend. My mind rushed with a million thoughts. Is it rude to put him in my purse? What parts of his body are in this bag? Does he know he's in my purse right now? Should I open the pocket so it's not so dark in there? But the biggest question? How the hell am I supposed to race with this little purple sack? Later that week, I went to the sporting goods store, Carlos still tucked in a pocket of my purse. "Can I help you?" the clerk asked. "Sure," I said. "I'm looking for some kind of small dry bag, maybe one I can wear around my neck." "We've got a few options," he said, leading me to the water sports aisle. "What activity are you doing, and what do you need to keep dry?" "An Ironman triathlon," I replied, "and, some human remains." The clerk's expression quickly changed from cheerful to disturbed. "I'm sorry, what did you—" "An iPhone," I quickly interrupted, laughing nervously at the realization of just how deranged I sounded. "I need to keep an iPhone dry." The clerk raised an eyebrow and pointed at a row of dry bags on display. "You'll probably find what you need here." He turned on his heel and sped away, most likely in search of a security guard. Neil and I flew to Austria, Carlos in tow. As the plane descended over the pristine lakes and lush green forests of the Austrian Alps, my heart fluttered. I couldn't wait to race. But another problem quickly revealed itself. Carlos's bike hadn't made the trip. When we landed at our destination, the bike box was conspicuously absent from the parade of suitcases unloaded at the baggage claim. "I think it might be in Paris," the the apathetic airline agent said as he typed a series of commands into his computer. "You think?" I asked, feeling my heartbeat pound in my ears. This couldn't be happening. "We will try to confirm," he replied without the least bit of interest. "If we find it, we'll get it to you right away."
"If you find it?" I screeched. "If?"
"I flew here with a bike. I need a bike. I have a race in 2 days." I was every cliché of a demanding, entitled American, and the Austrian agent was having none of it. His voice and demeanor remained monotone. "I'll see what I can do." For the next 24 hours, the updates from the airline were scattershot and devoid of hope. The bike has been located in Paris. It seems it is in Frankfurt now. We think it might have been delivered to our lost luggage storage in Berlin. We can't find it. Are you certain you brought it? My panic increased with every phone call. I tossed and turned, unable to sleep. Without a bike, I wouldn't be able to follow through on the promise I'd made to Carlos. Mere hours before the race, a bike box appeared in the doorway of my hotel room. I barely recognized the case. Its hard shell was cracked in 2 places, the handles were missing, and a wheel had come loose from its socket. Somewhere in Paris, Frankfurt, Berlin, God knows where, this case had been drop-kicked from a cargo hold. I held my breath as I opened the broken latches. Neil inspected the contents, nodding with a relieved sigh. The bike, by some miracle, had emerged from its impromptu transnational tour unscathed. Carlos had made it to Austria. So had his bike. I could finally race. I put on my swim cap, tucked the dry bag containing Carlos's ashes into my wetsuit, kissed my husband, and headed to the start line. It was time for one last Ironman. 15 minutes before the race, someone hugged me. With a heavy European accent, a tall, bearded man told me he loved me and was proud of me.
"You will do this, ja?"
"Who is that?" Neil asked as my cheerleader walked off.
"I have no idea," I said, laughing and dumbfounded. God, I loved Iron Man starts.
I recalled seeing my first start in Coeur d'Alene, standing there awkwardly, watching for Carlos, amid the buzz, the excitement, the hugs and high fives. So much had changed since that race, yet I still got goosebumps at every start line. Carlos was with me today, literally. He was hanging out in a tiny waterproof pouch around my neck while I swam in the crisp waters of the Austrian lake. He was right next to my heart as I rolled out on his bike for the challenging bike ride. His voice was in my head.
"Eat. Pace yourself. Don't be a dumbass."
This was not my race. This was Carlos's. I was just the vehicle. He was definitely there at mile 20 when I dropped my chain on the first climb.
"Just fix it and get back on."
And he was there at mile 25 when I couldn't find the right gear to shift into.
"Just ride the damn bike like I taught you to."
He was there at mile 30 when I began having trouble shifting from my big ring to my small ring. I left it in the hardest gear, gritted my teeth, and pushed the pedals.
Iron Man is supposed to be hard.
The corner of the bag containing his remains jabbed at my chest. At this point, Carlos was starting to chafe both my psyche and my skin. At the base of the course's biggest climb, a steep monster known as Rupertiberg, the bike simply refused to shift. I put my head down and grunted.
"It's supposed to be hard," I repeated to myself.
My legs burned, my vision blurred. I cursed the outdated piece of shit I was riding. I cursed Carlos. This was all his fault. I could barely breathe as I crested the climb, standing up on the pedals for leverage. Between my feet, I felt a loud, sudden clatter. The wheels suddenly stopped, sending me flying onto the pavement.
"What the hell, Lakey?"
I sat up gingerly and turned my attention to the mangled bike beside me. The derailleur, which was supposed to be affixed to the frame, was dangling from the chain. The attachment must have come loose during the jostling of travel. The race had dislodged the bolt completely. The bike was unrideable.
Fuck!
I screamed, slamming my fist on the pavement in frustration. This couldn't be happening. My breaths became shorter and shallower as I sat on the side of the road, watching fellow racers whiz by on the course. A few asked if I was okay. One, thinking I had a flat tire, tossed a spare tube my way. For some reason, it was that tube that did me in. Not the broken bike, not my tired legs, not the plastic bag poking a hole in my rib cage. It was the realization that I couldn't muscle my way out of this bad situation. I had been out-stubborned. The levee broke, and the tears finally came. I cried because Carlos had never quit a race, and I was about to fail him. I cried because he would have found a way to jerry-rig that broken bike, get to transition, and run to the finish line. I cried because I was such a dumbass. I cried because I couldn't tell him about this over a cup of coffee when I got home. I cried because I had a dead man hanging in a bag around my neck. I cried because I missed him. All I could do was hyperventilate on the side of the road, clutching the bag of ashes in my hand. I'm so sorry, Carlos. I'm so sorry. Are you okay? A rider asked as he slowed to approach me.
Was I?
I didn't know, but I nodded, waving him away. I couldn't face that question anymore. I shifted my weight and swung my legs over the guardrail on the side of the road, turning my back to the events behind me. I inhaled sharply. Holy shit! That view! For the entirety of my meltdown, I had never once bothered to look up. But from here, the highest point of the course, the views were absolutely stunning. There were majestic mountains and sparkling lakes. Far below, tucked among lush green hills, was a small village, its quaint cathedral poking out from a grove of trees. I understood why Carlos had picked this place for me to visit. It was magical, one of the most beautiful, tranquil scenes I had ever encountered. In my mind, I could see him doing his first Ironman here, climbing this hill, taking in this view, and feeling so alive. It's not about the Ironman. It was never about the Ironman.
Hey, you okay?
Someone tapped me on the shoulder. It was a race official, conducting a sweep of the course for riders who were unable to finish the race.
Yeah, I'm okay,
I said, wiping away the last of my tears. And I meant it. Neil, who was also racing that day, was surprised to see me waiting at the finish line when he crossed.
What happened?
He asked. I broke down again as I recounted my shit show of a day. The dropped chain, the missing bolt, the crash. He pulled me in for a hug.
You know what this means, right?
I didn't. Neil poked the lump protruding under my shirt.
That's the place Carlos wanted you to scatter his ashes.
I had been so focused on finishing the race that I hadn't even thought about scattering the ashes. Had Carlos really been trying to send me a message? Did he really have to go to all that trouble just to get me to look up? Neil laughed and kissed my forehead.
You're hard-headed, babe. He knew that.
The plan? I fly to Austria and do the Ironman. Afterward, I figure out where to scatter Carlos's ashes.
What actually happened?
Carlos led me to the place during the race. Early that evening, I drove back up to the top of the mountain and looked out at the view once more. In the twilight, the setting was even more idyllic than before. With a deep breath, I opened the satin bag.
"Thank you, sir," I whispered.
"I love you very much." I watched his ashes float down into the ravine below, dusting the leaves of the trees. It was exactly where he wanted to be.
"By the way,"
I smiled mischievously,
I think you'll need this. And then I threw that damned bike off the bridge, too. It flew gracefully through the air, then landed on the ash-dusted forest canopy. A random bike and a random tree. To a passerby, it wouldn't make a bit of sense. It was the perfect metaphor for our friendship. I think it would have made Carlos laugh. God knows I did. This concludes Life's Too Short to Go So Fucking Slow by Susan Lakey. Narrated by Amy McFadden. Copyright 2017 by Susan Lakey. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Velo Press and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.